This is a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
You're tuned in to the R1 News, your stop for news and current affairs on the airwaves. 11 to 12 weekdays here on Radio 1 91 FM. Te reo irirangi kotahi.
Kia ora, morena. You're listening to R1 News. My name's Amiria.
And my name's Nico.
And it is Tuesday, the 19th of July. Listener discretion is advised for our show this morning as we will be covering topics of suicide, domestic violence and alcohol abuse.
Coming up on the program I Tene Rā, we speak to Dr. Rose Crossan about a recent study by academics at the University of Otago, Christchurch, which has highlighted links between alcohol use and suicide rates in New Zealand. After that, we'll be joined by Juliana Carvalho, campaigner with Access Matters, about the accessibility of New Zealanders' bill, which is to be presented to Parliament in 2 weeks, and their Access Denied Diaries campaign. Following that, we have Dr. Carol Harrington from the School of Social and Cultural Studies at Victoria University of Wellington to explore the question of fact or fiction regarding the increase of domestic violence after sports game losses. At the end of our show, we'll be diving into what happened on this day in history and hear some fun facts of events which happened on the 19th of July in previous years.
But before all that, we'll have Eileen with news headlines and weather. And in the meantime, here's Bub with G's Louise. Stay tuned. You're listening to R1 News here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. Was G's Louise by Bub, and you're listening to R1 News here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. It is 5 minutes past 11, and we now have Eileen with news headlines and weather.
The R1 News headlines.
Tēnā koutou, ko Eileen aho. The People's Inquiry into Student Wellbeing has found thousands of students are living in poverty. Run by student unions and the Green Party, the inquiry was released on the same day as inflation hit its highest level since 1990, at 7.3%. The inquiry has found two-thirds of students regularly struggle to buy food, clothing, pay bills, access healthcare, or pay for transport, with disabled, Māori and Pacifica students struggling the most. Students are spending an average of 56% of their income on rent, according to the survey. Sam Blackmore, Vice President of the Union of Students Associations, says a universal education income to all students, regardless of their level of study, age or parental income, would help lift students out of material hardship. The results of the survey have sparked calls for immediate government action on student wellbeing. Europe is experiencing record high temperatures and wildfires as the continent faces an extreme heatwave. In France, experts are warning of a, quote, heat apocalypse, whilst in the UK, the first ever red extreme heat warning is in place. Wildfires have caused close to 25,000 to flee in France, with thousands more being forced to relocate in Spain, Portugal and Greece. Spain and Portugal have seen more than 1,000 deaths due to the heat in recent days. Around the world, heat waves have been increasing in frequency and intensity due to the climate crisis. And those were the headlines on R1 News. Now, ke te pēhea te āhua o te rangi. How's the weather?
The R1 News weather.
I tēnei rā, Ōtipoti is looking wet. Expect a high of Te Kaumārua, 12, and a low of Ono, 6, with rain easing to a few showers in the evening and southerly winds. Rā Apa, Wednesday, looks to be wet again, with rain and southerlies, a high of Waru, 8, and a low of Rima, 5.
That was the R1 News headlines. Catch up at r1.co.nz/news or find us at Radio 1 91 FM on Twitter or R1 News NZ on Instagram and tune in to R1 News at 11 a.m. on weekdays.
Kia ora, Eileen, for those headlines and weather. Up next, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Rose Crossan from the University of Otago regarding some recent research which has linked between alcohol use and suicide rates in New Zealand. But first, here's a song. This is No One Else by Molly Payton. Stay tuned.
I say I don't want you, would that make us alright? And when I'm with him, you go out of your mind. If I say I don't want you, would that make us alright?
Kia ora, you are tuned into Radio 1 91 FM. This is the R1 News Show. Just playing was Molly Payton with No One Else, and we're about to move into our first live interview of the show. Listener discretion is advised for this segment, as we will be discussing topics of alcohol abuse and suicide. A recent study by academics of the University of Otago, Christchurch, has highlighted links between alcohol use and suicide rates in New Zealand. This study is believed to be the first coronal data which has been used in this country to quantify the link between suicide deaths and acute alcohol use across the population. We are joined now live on air by Dr. Rose Crossan to speak about their findings. Kia ora, Rose. Can you hear me?
I can. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for joining. So I'm just going to begin by just asking you to tell us listening and here in studio a bit about your study and what motivated you to begin this research project.
Certainly. So starting with the question of motivation, so my research expertise is in drug and alcohol harms and how we go about preventing them. So one of the things that I am particularly interested in from a research perspective is the link between alcohol and other drugs and suicide, because they're both such pressing public health issues. And the World Health Organization actually assesses that alcohol is the second most significant risk factor for suicide behind major depression. But we seem to have a little bit of a knowledge gap in New Zealand about that association, which I thought needed to be filled. So in this study, we assessed coronial data from 2007 to 2020, and we then used the coronial data to determine the blood alcohol concentration of people who had died by suicide. And we found that 26% of people who died by suicide who were aged 15 or over in that time period had a blood alcohol concentration that was higher than the legal driving limit in New Zealand. And this was higher in populations that already have increased suicide rates. So there was also inequities within these findings.
And those findings really are quite groundbreaking in respects to just, again, highlighting these links. And regarding that, this study kind of paves the way to address it with further study and investigation into perhaps, I saw when I was reading up about the research, about different behavioural patterns, perhaps by females or different members of different communities within New Zealand. Is that correct? That's kind of opening a door for new research?
Absolutely. I mean, the association between alcohol and suicide is relatively well known, but as I said, we didn't have the data in New Zealand to be able to make a more sort of fulsome conclusion about this association here. So it's really important that we've now got New Zealand-specific data. And you're right, it does certainly, as all research does, it leads to further questions. I think that we've got further work to do about understanding alcohol-related suicide in females, because that was quite a surprising finding in our study. And also to look at whether or not patterns have changed over time. So this study, we pulled data from 2007 to 2020. But for some age groups, drinking patterns have changed quite substantially over that time period, so we need to look at whether or not changes in drinking patterns have been reflected in the proportion of suicide deaths involving alcohol.
Definitely. And regarding changes in patterns too, from my understandings as well, that these changes need to be charted in correlation to legislative change as well and meaningful policy change. Are you, along with the other researchers behind the study, hoping that we will be able to have policy and legislation change in correspondence with this new research?
Absolutely. you know, the all research, it's really important that we try and find a way to make our research impactful and useful. So what we're hoping for is population-level interventions to reduce alcohol-related harm and alcohol-related suicide in New Zealand, because that's where international evidence is strongest for effect.
Definitely. Thank you. And just before we wrap up this interview as well, do you have anything else that you'd like to share about this study, perhaps a finding that you weren't really expecting to come across, because it is relatively new research that has identified these like connections? So is there anything else that you'd like to add on about just the process perhaps of the research, or where you're hoping to take the next step?
I think that in terms of the next steps are really advocating for policy change. We have an opportunity to address this in New Zealand at the moment because of Chloe Swarbrick's alcohol harm reduction bill being drawn from the ballot and going to be debated. So I think we're at a kind of a critical time point where we can try to affect change. And all going well, if we have changes in alcohol policy, we may also be able to see that reflected in reductions in suicide rates, which has been seen internationally.
Definitely. And so it is very important just to have in public discussion and to be aware of it. Thank you so much, Dr. Rose, for joining us live on air and speaking to us about this very important subject and about this very important research that you have done. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That was Dr. Rose Crossan, who joined us to speak about their latest research study, which is believed to be the first to highlight the links between alcohol use and suicide rates in New Zealand. Now we are going to be moving into our second segment of the show, which is another live interview. But before that, here is Phoebe Bridges with Garden Song. Stay tuned, stay locked.
Up on the hill, and when your skinhead neighbor goes missing, I'll plant a garden in the yard. Then they're gluing roses on a flatbed. You should see it. I mean thousands. I grew up here till it all went up in flames, except the notches in the door frame. I don't know when you got taller. See our reflection in the water off the bridge at the Huntington. I hopped the fence when I was 17. Then I knew what I. It's gonna be just like my recurring dream. I'm at the movies, I don't remember what I'm seeing. The screen turns into a tidal wave. Then it's a dorm room like a hedge maze. And when I find you, touch my leg and I insist, but I wake up before we do it. I don't know how, but I'm taller. It must be something in the water. Everything's growing in our garden. Know that it's haunted.
This is the R1 News on Radio 1 91 FM. Te reo irirangi kotahi.
Control Myself by Leisure. It is currently 25 minutes past 11 and you're listening to R1 News here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. In 2 weeks, the Accessibility for New Zealanders Bill will be presented to Parliament. For the past 6 weeks, Access Matters, the Access Alliance, have been collating submissions for their hashtag Access Denied Diaries, recording people's experiences of the types of barriers they face every day, which will be presented to Members of Parliament in support of the creation for a robust piece of legislation towards a more inclusive Aotearoa. We are now joined by lead campaigner Juliana Cavallio to hear more about the Accessibility for New Zealanders Bill and the Access Matters campaign. Kia ora, how's it going?
Hi, kia ora. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks.
Everything is going good. We're very excited with the introduction of the bill.
So this bill has been in the works for a while. How did it come about? And can you tell me a bit about what it's expected to include?
Yeah, so, well, the Access Matters campaign was launched in 2017. And I have the privilege of being campaigning since 2017, when a group of organizations from the disability sector came together to call on the government to commit to introduce accessibility legislation, because our vision of accessible Aotearoa for all New Zealanders, including disabled people, people that support people with disabilities, parents, people who have English as a second language, And the most strategic way of achieving our vision was through a systematic level and accessibility legislative framework. So the movement has grown since then. Now we have over 40 supporting organizations, business champions, more than 20,000 people that have, you know, been volunteering, successfully campaigning, supporting, and eagerly to participate in the introduction of the accessibility legislation into Parliament next week.
So what...
Of course.
Sorry, you keep going?
No, no. Of course, we haven't seen the bill yet, but there was a cabinet paper that was released on May and suggesting what the legislation will look like. And for us, the legislation will definitely lack real force and effect because the legislation proposed will set a leadership structure of a new accessibility governance board made of disabled people appointed by the minister for disability, and a chief executive. The accessibility governance board role is to provide independent voice to the minister on barriers and potential solutions for removal. But the powers of the board are very limited, with no regulatory rulemaking mechanism and no complaint function or dispute resolution process. And the proposal differs from the preferences of the disability community, the majority of the disability community. So we canvassed some feedback from our supporters, and this doesn't match, definitely doesn't match the supporters' expectation. And we are in the process of summarizing this feedback to include in when the select committee process starts.
Okay, so on that note, what would this framework ideally look like?
Well, the framework idea will look like... last year, a group of legal researchers, Warren Foster, Don Barraclough, and Curtis Barnes, they released a report called Making New Zealand Accessible, a Design for Effective Accessibility Legislation. And this report, it's perfect. You know, it has everything that this ideal framework needs. It outlines five essential elements for effective legislation framework. One, of course, the Act itself. Second, standards. Three, a regulator. Four, a notification, barrier notification process. And five, a dispute resolution process, like a tribunal. This report is available on our website, and www.accessmatters.org.nz, and there is also a summary document available, you know, to unpack the legal speak as well as recording of the explainer session that we run last year.
What difference will an effective accessibility bill make for New Zealanders?
Well, I think that takes us back right to the beginning of the why we started the campaign. It will make it possible for all New Zealanders to enjoy everyday life, you know, and to fully participate in society. Everybody will have the opportunity to learn, to get a job, to take part in community, social life. And we know that many people, this is not the experience. I can talk for myself as well, as a person with a disability. It is really exhausting. It is exhausting to have everyday constantly to find workarounds just to get through the day, you know, in this world that is not designed for us. This unnecessary burden can no longer be, you know, shouldered just by people with disabilities, and we are 25% of the population. So our call is to everyone that today doesn't have any access needs, but in some point of life might have. We need a reminding 75% of the population to come together with us and, you know, stand with us, take notice, and empathize, have some empathy, and fight with us for this effective accessibility legislation. I give you a quick example. Till I was 19, I had no disability, and I never took notice of anything, you know, that was, I was completely unaware of accessibility, and was a different world for me. Until one day I have this inflammation in my spinal cord and became disabled. And, you know, as a person that experienced life fully without a disability and knowing my rights, now I'm the same, exactly same person. And so many of my rights were took away just because I can no longer walk and I'm in a wheelchair. So I think, you know, it's a duty to fight for not only for my rights, but for the rights of other people with disabilities. It should be the same for people that doesn't have a disability. You know, please join us to fight. I'm sure that we all know someone that when they, you know, you broke a leg, sprained an ankle, and it was really hard to get around. Or, you know, you were in a restaurant, it was really hard, difficult to read a menu because not much light available. Or you struggle to engage in a conversation because of the noise, or you find it difficult to get about with a young children or a disabled relative or friend, you know. So at some level, if you have this empathy, we know how difficult it is, how frustrating it is when you cannot fully participate.
Could you tell us a bit more about the Access Matters campaign and the kind of submissions that have been received through the Access Denied Diaries?
Sure. So we in the last 6 weeks, we've been compiling a dossier of evidence about disabling experiences encountered by many people in Aotearoa, New Zealand, where they're trying to navigate everyday life. So far, we have received nearly 100 stories that range from really unnecessary, annoying obstacles to life-inhibiting and dignity-destroying systemic discrimination. And these stories cover every imaginable area of life. So some examples that we can draw from. So this is the voting information packs that we're not providing in accessible format for the previous local election in the area. So this person had to use the previous support, the precious support hours to have the voting information booklet read to him, you know. Or there was another person that submitted a story that was really difficult to find an employer who can make necessary accommodations. Simple things such as breaking down instructions better, or simply not giving so many instructions at the same time so this person could work. The other one told about the footpath in the area that have been terrible for many years. Broken curbs, broken concrete, blocked footpath, and they have to, this person had to approach the Auckland Council several times about it, but they just won't do anything. And imagine, it's just like this, you cannot come across, you know. There was the other person that told that when they went to the Taste High Park but couldn't play with the siblings because the wheelchair can get through the playground. And this is because there is a wooden barrier around the entire playground. And then this kid just had to sit in the wheelchair and watch the siblings play. I had a very similar situation when I was trying to take my niece to the playground. Again, the same wooden barrier around the entire playground, and she was wanting me to, you know, to push her in the swing, and I just couldn't, so I had to ask for a stranger to give her a push. You know, it's simple to solve. There was another story of a new built high-tech world-class sporting facility built to modern, you know, very fancy, with the building code specifications permitted to provide proper facilities for proper people with disabilities. Downstairs, where the public do not sit, it has provided accessible toilet facilities. The other one was prior to a recent procedure at the Wellington Hospital. This person was given a small print text paperwork stating all the important things that he should do, should observe when going to the hospital for the operation. But he's blind, so it was impossible for him to read the information. So we have a lot of stuff to do. We have a lot of work to do.
Thanks so much for coming on today and sharing about your campaign and the requirement for a good accessibility bill for New Zealand.
If I can add, I think we need to lobby the government to move for a stronger, harder accessibility that will fully, you know, make New Zealand fully accessible for all New Zealanders. So if you're listening to us today, please share your stories. Use the hashtag AccessDenyTheDiaries on the website accessmatters.org.nz. Talk to your network. Even if you don't have a disability, as I said, have some empathy. Do your bit, you know, to help us, you know, to have the life that we deserve. And prepare for the select committee process because we are creating a submission toolkit to help people to share and construct their own unique and compelling select committee submission with the Access Matters campaign team on hand and available to help. Our goal is to make history by having 15,000 unique written submissions to the selected committee and 1,000 oral submissions. And it's possible, you know, we just need to have people taking action, caring about the issue and taking action. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Juliana Cavallio, campaigner for Access Matters, talking about the upcoming Accessibility for New Zealanders Bill, which will be presented to Parliament in 2 weeks. It is currently 11:39 a.m. You're listening to R1 News on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. I'm going to play a tune. This is Heavy Chest with Sunday 926 featuring Benny. And up next, we're going to have another live interview, so stay tuned.
Tell a lie, will you stop and say?
You are tuned in to R1 News on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. The time is currently 42 minutes past 11 and we are about to move into our third live interview for today's news show. Listener discretion is advised for this segment as we will be discussing domestic violence and alcohol use. With the weekend's rugby game having passed, discussion commenced about whether the common held perception that there is an increase in intimate partner violence after sports games is more fact or more fiction. Reaching out to the Women's Refuge, they responded with a statement which said that they caution blaming an increase in alcohol use for escalating family violence, and that alcohol alone can never cause abuse, and most people who drink even harmful amounts don't use violence. Further, they said that on this myth, after an increase of violence after sports games losses, there is research to suggest that whether it's a win or a loss, that perhaps there is violence. But on the whole, this theory is more myth and is based on an anecdote. Alcohol use can make violence more likely, but it's not the same, and saying it is an excuse. To further discuss this, as it is quite interesting, as it does seem to be a common held public belief, or at least in some discourses that we've been exposed to, we are about to be joined live on air by Dr. Carol Harrington from the School of Social and Cultural Studies at Victoria University of Wellington. We're going to bring her on live right now. Kia ora, Carol. Can you hear us?
Yes, kia ora, Nico.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
That's fine. It's good to talk to you.
So I just want to begin by asking, why do you personally think that there is a commonly held perception that domestic violence does increase after a loss of major sporting events? Like, is there any support for this, or how do you think that this myth came about just in discourse?
I think it's really interesting, and I was thinking about it, that possibly it's the sense that the loss of the sports game is so devastating that there'll be some tragic outbreak of violence, and it represents how wrapped up people are in some certain sports and how significant they think it is. But I also think it represents a misconception of what domestic violence looks like, and that what some studies have shown is that there's increased reporting of violent incidents to the police after sports, whether it's a win or loss. But most domestic violence is around about coercive control, so it's an ongoing pattern of behaviour. It's not to do with any discrete incident. So whether or not there's an incident of physical violence, that's part of a bigger pattern of coercive and control that can involve monitoring someone's phone and who they see and where they go and how they behave in the house and what they're doing at any point in time. And so violence is a threat that backs that kind of control up, but it's not the totality of what domestic violence looks like. And so, you know, the research isn't conclusive, but even if there are more reports to the police, that's still only a small slice of the intimate partner violence that's happening in society.
Definitely. And just building off of that about how statistics are not fully conclusive about what domestic violence looks like or how it can be just kind of calculated. It was mentioned as well in the Women's Refuge statement in response to our initial questions that statistics are quite hard to get in regards to domestic violence. And do you think, I guess, just building on this point, that this is one of the reasons why that this myth is quite common in public just discourse, because it is very hard to actually conceptualize how like deep this issue is of domestic violence or what it looks like?
Yeah, I think that's right, that a lot of people don't have a clear picture of what domestic violence is. And I guess it plays into some of the stereotypes around men's sports, that they are associated with violence. And there's been quite a lot of research about sports teams and violence, and also kind of the other flip side of that is the excuses made for sports figures who are accused of violence. And so if certain sports, male sports, embody the ideals of masculinity that we value, if we think that sports is associated with men's violence, it's also suggesting an acknowledgement that men's violence is part of the culture of sport, and so that the society sort of braces itself that if we have a big sports event, that's going to create certain harmful forms of masculinity. So I'm just kind of thinking aloud here, but it's almost like reflecting an ambivalence we have about the sorts of masculinity that we as a society celebrate.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And before we let you go, I think you did bring up a really good point just about how it is kind of in tandem with just like hegemonies about what sports and what sporting is like in New Zealand being a very you know, masculine dominated field with like key sports teams like the All Blacks. So do you personally think that, or just think perhaps that when we try and consider violence and we consider sports, that there needs to be a bit of a cultural and social change about how we conceptualize violence and just the nature of sports games and what they should actually bring and like harness, that it should be separated from how it is currently considered?
Yeah, it would be great if our idealized sports heroes did project non-violent forms of masculinity and make it really, really clear that violence against women in particular, violence against children and violence against anyone, but since we're talking about intimate partner violence, it's generally against women partners, and that that's unacceptable. And so that if we had that kind of leadership and clear messaging, that would be great. And also that culturally that we don't celebrate or excuse violence when it does make it into the public view, which with prominent sports people it does sort of with some regularity.
Well, thank you very much for joining us and for shedding a bit of light on this myth and how it has come about and perhaps what we really need to, as a community, look at and question more. So thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Carol, and yeah, have a great day and thank you for discussing this with us.
Okay. Thanks very much. It was good to talk to you.
Bye.
Bye.
That was Dr. Carol Harrington from the School of Social and Cultural Studies at the Victoria University of Wellington talking to us and shedding a bit more light on the common held myth and perception that domestic violence and IPV does increase after losses of major sports matches. Very interesting and important to discuss. We are now, before we move into our final segment of the show, where we discuss some zany and fun things that happened on previous days on the 19th of July throughout history, going to move into another song. This is Weary Donna with You Should Be Smiling. Stay tuned and stay locked on R1 News. Thank you.
That was You Should Be Smiling by Witty Donna. It is 11:55 a.m. and you're listening to R1 News here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. And it's time for a new segment here on our show called This Day in History. Today is Latu, Tuesday the 19th of July, and we're going to look back at some of the crazy things which have taken place on this day in the past.
First off, can you believe that we are going to be starting with a fun fact that takes place in outer space? On the 19th of July, 1969, Apollo 11 entered orbit around the moon with famous astronomer Neil Armstrong, who was, of course, the first human to step foot on the moon. That is pretty cool.
That is a fun fact.
That is a very fun fact.
In the world of news today, on the 19th of July, 1903... the first Tour de France was won by Maurice Garin. The race covered 2,428 kilometres. And another fun fact, the 2022 Tour de France is currently underway. It's the 109th edition of this famous cycling race.
Oh, my gosh. It's so long as well. I didn't realise that it was that long. Like, I know it's the Tour de France.
It's
but
a 20-plus day event. It's crazy.
That is very
That's
crazy.
A lot of cycling.
Okay, moving on, in regarding TV events, on the 19th of July 2007, the first episode of Mad Men debuted. Set in the 1960s, Mad Men follows the story of advertising agents in Manhattan, New York City. Created by Matthew Weiner, the show ran for 7 seasons. Among others starred John Hamm, Elizabeth Moss, and Vincent Kartheiser. I think I butchered his name.
Have you watched much Mad Men?
I have to admit I haven't, but I think now I need to.
It's such a cool cinematic vibe, the 60s vibes.
I can imagine it being very styly. I think I'd quite like it.
Crazy show. And our final fact is a very fun one. This is a music fact. As on the 19th of July 1996, the Spice Girls made their debut on UK TV on the music show Top of the Pops, where they performed their debut single Wannabe. The song topped the Billboard Hot 100 for over 4 weeks and became the best-selling single by a girl group in the world.
Whoa, I didn't know that. That's a really cool fact.
Yeah, me either. It's crazy the stuff you learn.
I know, and that's why this will now be a regular segment.
So should we wrap up what we've talked about today on R1 News?
Yes, I think we should. And also everything will be available to listen to on Spotify and is it SoundCloud as well? That we've got little podcasts which you can listen to if you've missed out.
It's all on the website as well.
On the R1 website. So make sure if you haven't listened to a segment but you are keen to check it out that you can find them all here. So we've had a show which we have provided a couple of listener discretion little warnings because we have covered some quite sensitive and intense topics of the show. The first live interview we had, we spoke to Dr. Rose Crossan from the University of Otago Christchurch on a recent study that has highlighted links between alcohol use and suicide rates in New Zealand. These findings also call for new legislative and harm reduction action through policy change.
Then we heard from Juliana Cavallio about the Accessibility for New Zealanders Bill, which is to be presented to Parliament in 2 weeks, and the campaign happening at the moment under the hashtag AccessDeniedDiaries.
And then following that, our third live interview, we spoke with Dr. Carol Harrington from the School of Social and Cultural Studies at Victoria University of Wellington about whether domestic violence increases after sports losses. Is it fact or fiction? It is more fiction, definitely. And then we just wrapped up with a lovely round of our first... What have you coined it?
Should we coin it This Day in History? Or we'll work on the title for On This Day.
For now, it's This Day in History, On This Day. And
should we leave you with a really fun song related to This Day in History?
Yes, so you can keep up to date on your facts that happen on This Day in History.
So coming up next, we've got Wannabe by the Spice Girls. Keep it locked with Tadeo.
You've been tuned in to the R1 News, weekdays from 11 to 12 here on Radio 1 91 FM, Tadeo Irirangi Kotahi. Catch up at r1.co.nz/news or find us at Radio 1 91 FM on Twitter or R1 News NZ on Instagram.
Thanks for listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. There are heaps more at r1.co.nz.